Hello, I'm John Wilson. Thank you for downloading this edition of Master Tapes from BBC Radio 4.
Welcome to Master Tapes and to David Crosby and his band playing live at the BBC Maidavale Studios. He's here to take us back to the making of his 1971 debut album, which came in the wake of his work with both the Byrds and rock and roll's first supergroup, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. David's first solo album was If I Could Only Remember My Name, a record that included tracks such as Cowboy Movie, Laughing and Music Is Love. David Crosby, welcome to Master Tapes. And we heard you there at the top of the programme playing Music Is Love, the first track on this album. And in a way, it sets the tone for this album, doesn't it? Musically, lyrically and spiritually.
In a way, yeah. It's a very complex situation. But this particular thing, I had that much. I had... And the... So I'm sitting there fooling around with it in studio. Graham's there, Neil's there.
Nash and Young for the uninitiated.
Oh, yeah. I'm fooling with it. And so Neil, you know, starts playing along. Graham starts singing with it. We get to the end and we're like, wow, that was fun. Graham says, I think that's the beginning of your album. And he's a pretty smart fella. But I said, you know, bullshit. It can't be, you know. Is that okay to say?
You're right. You're okay.
Yeah, because we're going to talk about some risque stuff here, you know. And they said, oh, yeah, it is. Give us the tape. They overdubbed. Now, I want you to know that Neil does not know how to play bass, who played the bass. And Nash does not know how to play congas, who played the congas.
Right, okay.
And I don't know which one of them played the vibes. I have still to this day no idea. And they brought me back the tape, and they said, now it's the beginning of your record, right?
Wow.
And I listened to it, and it was good.
And that is the spirit in which this record was made. A lot of people dropping into the studio, just contributing ideas.
Yes, there was a lot of this. I would, particularly Garcia, who would come every night.
This is Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead.
It would have been him, yes. And and the Airplane and the Dead were both recording in the same complex at the same time. And so whoever showed up, really, was the band.
And there's a room full of people here tonight who know all these stories, who love this music. But for people listening at home who have heard of you and have heard of Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, that may not know the backstory. Before that, there was the Byrds, and that was your first band that you started out in with Roger McGuinn. And that was a great run of hits with that band as well.
What's good? What's good? I mean, I'd be humble, but I don't know how. But, probably why they tossed me out.
Right, yeah. Well, I was going to say, because you didn't leave on your own accord.
No.
They threw you out.
They did. And then they said, as they exited the house, we'll do better without you. Which I think they probably regretted.
Yeah. So what you did is you hooked up with Stephen Stills and Neil Young, who had just left Buffalo Springfield, and Graham Nash, who had just come from England and left the Hollies.
The truth was, I stole him. I think Alan Clark is going to come in the door with a gun someday and say, you...
Alan Clark, his old songwriting partner in the Hollies. Have you ever had that conversation with him?
No.
Right.
I don't think I dare. I mean, you got to understand, Alan and Graham were friends from when they were
in school.
Yeah. You got to give it to those guys. They sang their way out of what was then a pretty grim industrial city.
And Graham Nash turned up in Laurel Canyon where you were. You remember the first time that you came together and you heard your voices together?
Absolutely. Cass called me up and said, I've got somebody you got to meet.
This is Mama Cass from Mamas and the Papas. So you were hanging out together. She knew him already.
She knew him already. She loved him. I think it happened organically, but I know that the afternoon that I met him, we were, let's see, can you say this on the radio?
Give it a try.
Herbally enhanced.
No, you don't say.
And that's delicate, huh?
Really?
Good little euphemism.
Late 60s in Laurel Canyon, California. Yeah. Who would have believed it?
Well, I... yeah, who'd have thunk it? Anyway, I got Graham blitzed, and we liked each other. He's funny.
Was Stephen Stills involved in the picture at that point?
I was already playing with Stephen, because he had songs. He had songs. Oh, the guy can write. And I had been, you know, thrust into the cold. And so, you know, Stephen was a welcoming soul, and we had a great time.
But you were imagining, I guess, at that point, two-part harmonies. But with the arrival of Graham Nash, something different happens in the air when three of you together.
It was shocking. It was like being dumped into ice water. You couldn't believe how good it sounded to Stephen and I, because we had been in bands that were basically two-part harmony. And two-part and three-part are completely different, and I'll explain why when he tells me to.
David, tell us the difference between two-part and three-part harmony at this appropriate juncture in the program.
What people normally do when they sing in harmony is they sing what's called a triad. Bass note is here. That's the root. We call it the root, the melody. And then there's the third, that's a major third, that's a minor third, that's a major third, and the fifth, or that's the fifth, and this is the major third, and that's the minor third. So it's bum, down, 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 which is the octave. If you're singing two-part, which I did all the way through the Birds, you create tension and release by changing the interval between you and the melody. What's a good example? 8 miles High.
Okay.
It's a great example. You want to hear it?
Yeah. You need some help on this. You need another voice, and I'm not going to do it.
This is my friend Shane Fontaine. He's from here. Right. 2, 3, 4.
8 miles high, and when you touch down, you find that it's stranger than known.
As you can hear, those are not parallel at all. Music started out with fourths and fifths. That's the Trappist monks and the Gregorian stuff. And then they started putting a third, a major or a minor third in it, and then they found the seventh. That's how it developed. But
you weren't working your way through musical theory when you sat down with Stephen Stills and Graham Nash and then later Neil Young. This was just totally intuitive musical response to what was happening in the room. And you're chasing notes around the air then, I guess.
Yeah, I'm musically illiterate. My son can score for an orchestra, but I can't read it. I have no training whatsoever. You know, we just did what felt good.
We just had a burst of the Birds there, so we've got 3-for-1 offer here tonight, because we got talking about your solo album. We're going to have some Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and then we just had the Birds. So that's the backstory, and that takes you to the point where you've recorded, well, one Crosby, Stills and Nash record, and then a Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young record with Deja Vu. So what took you to the first solo record? What was that about? About breaking free from what had already become quite a claustrophobic musical setup?
Truthfully, and this is a little down. My girlfriend had been killed in a car crash, and I had no way to deal with it. And the only place that I could exist really was in the studio. So I just stayed in the studio. When we finished Deja Vu, I just stayed in the studio. Some nights I'd be in there by myself, and then I would start doing what I call the Mormon Tabernacle me, stacking vocals. Sometimes 9 of my vocals in a stack. 3 parts, 3 on each part.
We hear that particularly on the last track on the album, on I Swear There Was Somebody There.
That one probably took us 12 and a half minutes, all improvised, and it wound up with one of my best things that I ever did.
And in that case in particular, you are literally singing your way out of grief. Yeah. Because it wasn't long before that you'd lost your girlfriend, Christine, in that car crash. And so, I mean, you must have been absolutely devastated. But music came and music saved you. Music got you out of that dark place. Then.
Music is most definitely. Music and my friends saved my life.
Yeah. I mean, you'd increasingly, if we look back through all of your musical journey, you're increasingly, it seems to be chasing a place where you can exist in a very free musical place. But then again, thinking, I read your book, Long Time Gone, many years ago, and there's a fantastic story about being in a club and watching John Coltrane and being pushed to the back of the club by the force of the music. Oh, and yeah. Something happened to you that night. And jazz has always played a, you know, people think of you as a folk singer, a rock and roll singer, well, but really, jazz plays a big part as well, though.
It's the truth. My brother, who was also a musician, started turning me on to 50s jazz. Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, Dave Brubeck. And, of course, once you start loving jazz, all roads lead to Train and Miles. And I'm not the most skilled guitar player, as you probably noted. I'm not a lead player. You know, so that's when I started doing tunings.
But when you say tunings, you're changing the tunings of the guitar.
Right.
A lot of those open
normal
tunings.
Normal guitar is when you play a D chord, you've got this E on the bottom that doesn't work. So you cleverly, you put it in a D too. And that's the beginning of the trouble. Because now the D sounds really good and you love it. I mean, there's all kinds of things you can do with it. Then it gets weirder. This is the tuning that I got Guinevere and Deja Vu out of.
And Guinevere is one of the tracks on the first Crosby, Stills & Nash record.
Right.
So you bring that along to the studio and you say, hey, guys, I've got a tune here.
And Nash goes, oh, whoopee. And Stills goes, what?
What? He doesn't want your tunes on that record?
He wanted it. He knew it was good. Steven knows what's good.
Right.
He's very much into time. Okay, so this song goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. But then it goes to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then. And I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew it worked until one of the Grateful Dead went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6, 7, 1, 2. I think that flustered Steven slightly.
Did you have lyrics there and then?
Mm.
Can you do it now?
Mm. That's such a strange lick. I think that's part of what really threw Steven.
Yeah. For contractual reasons, we're unable to include complete songs in our downloads. But if you'd like to hear the full version of this and other songs recorded during the sessions, head to the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website.
Yesterday, seagulls circle endlessly, and I sing in silent harmony.
So you're bringing songs in. Stephen Stills has got a whole stack of songs. Graham Nash is starting to write songs. And
great.
Then Neil Young joins the group as well.
And we didn't, at first, want him.
Well,
we knew that the Buffalo Springfield had imploded.
Because of creative tensions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're all egotistical, crazy musicians, you know, and we're not easy to get along with.
And we've got to say at this point that you wrote the rule book very much on rock and roll behavior. Particularly those chapters marked drugs and sex.
I think we break the rule. But, you know, we didn't know what we were doing, and we had millions of dollars. And we were crazy. So that combination, you know, can not bode well.
When you went into the studio in 1971 to record If I Could Only Remember My Name, was there a relief because you had spent so much time in the studio with Stills and Nash and Young, all bringing songs in and all fighting for space on records? Is that... No, you shouldn't.
No, we didn't fight about it. We knew which songs would work. I mean, you know, it's not much agonizing over, do you want to sing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes? I think maybe. There was really almost no dissension about the songs.
And it really is a diverse range of sounds on those first two records. And, you know, you get the really beautiful, gentle stuff, the Guinevere's, or, you know, something like Wooden Ships, which is taking off into all sorts of new territories. And then also, you're part of the late 60s, early 70s. You're very much rooted in the American counter-cultural movement. So this is a band that has a lot of apparent creative tension, but seemingly also brought together by a shared ideal and vision of what America could be. And there's one record in particular, which in a response to the appalling shooting of the students on the Kent State University campus. And there's a story, the way I've always heard it is Neil Young picks up the phone and says, I've got a song, we've got to get into the studio now. No. And you recorded Ohio.
No, how it happened is he and I were out for a drive in his Woody, and we went to a friend's house in Butano Canyon in California. And we were sitting there waiting for him to come back with stuff so we could cook breakfast. And he came back with that, I think it was Life magazine, wasn't it, that had the picture on the cover of the girl kneeling over the kid dead in the
on the university
face
campus,
down in blood. And
they'd been protesting against Vietnam and the war
and
in Cambodia as well.
I watched his face. You know, he looked at that picture. He didn't bother to read anything. He just looked at that picture. And he knew what had happened. We all knew. And I think I handed him the guitar, but maybe he just picked it up. And I watched him. He wrote it right there, the whole thing, all in one shot, bang. I, of course, was gobsmacked, and I immediately jumped on the phone and said, Graham, get us a studio now, right now. Call Stills, wake him up, get a studio, we're on our way. And Neil and I went down to Los Angeles, and we recorded that and Find the Cost of Freedom, another
amazing,
astounding still
with
song.
Harmonies. Yeah. And the thing is about Ohio, it is such an angry song. It's probably the greatest protest song ever written in that respect. It's all of you singing together. Neil Young takes the lead. But at the end, there is a cry, a desperation. Why? How many more? And you put your hand up straight away. And there's a sense of real emotional despair on that record.
You know, for a lot of Americans, it's been a very hard ride for us. We had to fight to get black people in our country the right to vote in their own country and not be shunted to the back of the bus. We had to spend 10 years trying to stop the Vietnam War, which we all knew was several words I can't say. A country is an idea. It's not a piece of turf. It's a set of principles, a set of values. And they were just going all to hell. And so I was angry. I was angry.
You do it on the album as well, on the debut album. There's a song called What Are Their Names as well,
yeah,
which is also, I mean, you would regard, I guess, as a political song. And that's more about sort of embedded establishment.
Do you want me to sing it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who are the men who really run this land? And why do they run it with such a thoughtless hand? What are their names, and on what streets do they live? I'd like to ride right over this afternoon and give them a piece of my mind about peace for mankind. Peace is not an awful lot to ask.
And the way you sing that, Cross, with the commitment and the passion, I guess you feel that song's just as relevant now as it was when you recorded it in 1971.
Even more. Back then, they were hiding more in the shadows. Now it's just blatant. You can buy a congressman for the price of a Mercedes. It's really easy. They do whatever they've been bought to do. But it's tough to be an American and hold your head high now. I mean, when we go overseas, we pretend we're Canadians. Oh, yeah, a little maple leaf, you know. It's just, I don't know, people are friendlier. Everybody loves Canadians. They're polite.
But that kind of clear-eyed response to political issues of the day, and you get it and Find the Cost of Freedom, or What Are Their Names, or Ohio, and all of those songs,
But then at the same time, you were doing so many drugs and you were really losing your way, weren't you? And that came between you and your musical friends. But also, did it not obscure that sense of clear-eyed purpose?
It obscured everything. It's a very tough thing. One of the best ways you can describe how detrimental it was, and yes, that's where the tension between us came from, because we were crazy. I was to a point of being psychotic. You know, it's so tough. We just didn't know what we were doing. We had no idea. Take a person's writing, and my writing just went less and less and less and less as the drug curve went up and up and up. And when they crossed, you know, I didn't even notice. And I realized at a certain point that I had stopped writing. Now, I'm not the best writer, but to see it go away and know for sure why, it's a hell of a lesson, which I unfortunately didn't learn until I woke up in a cell in a Texas prison, which is a tough way.
And that's what got you straight then, that time in prison. Because which time, I mean, you were freebasing cocaine, you were in a terrible state
I was. And, you know, it was a very hard way to go. Hey, rock star, how you feel now? It wasn't good, you know. Hey, Vern, come look, he's throwing up again. I'm totally glad it happened. It saved my life. I actually wrote a thank you letter to the judge. I said, listen, I know that every day the recidivism rate is so high that the same people keep showing back up again, making the same damn mistake, and this time I didn't.
I've talked to so many people that have been through that kind of experience, and they say, looking back, I wouldn't really change anything. I'm okay. I'm here now. From where you're talking now, it sounds like if you had it all again and could do it all again, would you do it differently?
Absolutely, man. You know what the biggest sacrifice was? Time. Time that I wasted. Time is really the final currency. Not money, not power. It's time. You have a certain amount of time, and nowhere near enough. You need 200 years. I've got 5 languages I want to learn and 3 different kinds of scientific disciplines I want to learn, and I've got no time.
And you said at the beginning of this interview, this album, If I Could Only Remember My Name, was partly influenced and informed by a sense of grief because you'd lost your girlfriend, Christine. It's also informed by a room full of trusted friends and great musicians coming together. But it's also the sound of people doing drugs as well, isn't it?
It was more, you know,
smoking.
Which is not an evil, desperate, destructive thing. It was a little bit later than that that it kind of all went to pieces.
David, it's a great pleasure talking to you and listening to you play. But for now, this is all we have time for in the first part of this edition of Master Tape. So my thanks to David Crosby. There'll be a lot more conversation and music from David in the second part of this edition of Master Tape, the B-side. You can hear that tomorrow afternoon at 3:30 here on Radio 4. Head to the website for more information about this programme and to listen to previous editions and to see videos of some of our Master Tapes guests performing live here at the BBC Maid of Ale Studios. You'll be able to watch this one. It's David Crosby and his band performing. What are you going out with, David?
What are we going to do?
Yeah.
You tell me.
Laughing, isn't it?
Oh, joy.
Are you going to give us Laughing? One of the tracks from the album, If I Could Only Remember My Name. Remember, you can find the full version of this and other songs recorded during our live sessions on the Master Tapes pages at the Radio 4 website, along with photographs, videos, and the other editions of the series.
I thought that I met a man who said he knew a man who knew what was going on. I was mistaken.